This is the workshop speaker meeting on the topic of fake it till you make it, and I would like to introduce our first speaker, Mike.
Hi, my name is Mike.
Mike.
I got asked to do this meeting about a week ago. And I got asked to do some other meetings, and they kind of didn't fit my recovery, so I kind of turned them down. And then somebody asked me to do this one, and then I said I would do it. And, you know, and I started thinking about it. It's fake it till you make it into basic text. And I couldn't think anywhere it was. I even tried to Google it, came up with some cool stuff on Google and everything about it, and but it's not really in there that I know of. I could be wrong, but and so I started thinking about it, and my wife had some great ideas, and you know, and I was praying about it, and then I sat down on my bed, and I was just thinking about it. I had my basic text out, looking in that, and then and I looked over on the wall, and on the wall, because I've been coming around since 1988, I think, was my first NA meeting, and so that's where it started. And you know, I've been coming since 88, and now I got 21 years clean, so I didn't stay clean the whole time, but I have a lot of key tags, and you know, so I decided to bring them because it just kind of fits faking it till you make it. And so I brought it. So as you see, it's pretty long. At one point, I had 6 years clean and used. I've had a year several different times, and I've had 30, 60, 90, 30, 60, 90, several times, one days. There's probably more than that on there, because so many times I came here, because when I came here, I realized that the answer was in Narcotics Anonymous. I just didn't know how to get it. So I kept coming back. And every time I would use or something, I knew I had to come back here. And a lot of times I came back here, I tried it my own way. I tried it for a long time without doing any step work. Kind of faked that, you know, and it never really worked out, you know. And then I got in a relationship with somebody in Narcotics Anonymous with 90 days clean. And it wasn't working out. So then we got married, and then it really didn't work out. You know, and I got a year clean, and then I got almost 18 months and used again. And my sponsor at the time, I called him, you know, after I got done using again, and he was just like, man, he said, the common denominator in all this is you, and you ain't done step one. When are you going to start doing some work and looking at who Mike is? So you have something to take into a relationship. And man, that kind of hurt. I heard what he was saying, and you know, and I was trying to scruff it off, but I had to get out of that relationship. When I met her in an NA meeting, and you know, I moved into her house and everything. My two kids that I had at the time were, what, four, five and seven or something like that. And her two kids were like 9 and 12. And man, it was a mess trying to raise kids, trying to stay clean, and it wasn't working. So I had to go back. I left out of there and went back to my parents' house. Thank God they still let me in. They tried to save me so many times, and I took everything they had. And they did it one more time, and I remember my sponsor was like, you need to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. And so that's what I did. I went to 90 meetings in 90 days, and man, I had so many problems, and I would call them up, and I would say, man, this is going on. And it was all this drama. And he was like, calm voice, he would say, you're making mountains out of molehills. All that stuff don't matter. You just need to stay clean today. Don't use, no matter what. And it got me through a lot of things. And it started me on a path, and I started doing step work. And the step work got me to 6 years, and then I stopped doing step work. I stayed out of a relationship for like 2.5 years of that time. I was kind of celibate. I didn't date nobody. I wasn't trying to pick up anybody, but I had girlfriends in recovery. They're friends, girls that are friends, and like they knew that I was a safe guy to be around. So I would hang out with them, and I didn't hit on them. And today, they're still my friends, which is incredible to have. They're like sisters to me, and they're still clean. And so I learned a lot of stuff. So then, and I had a friend that was in recovery that she started coming around, and we were friends first, and she ended up being my wife. And with 6 years clean, I picked up because I stopped doing the step work, and I stopped doing all the things that I needed to do. And then I tried to fake it like I had something going on. And it didn't work out well because my feelings got hurt, and I'd stopped doing the work. And I even went to a meeting, and I was talking to people in the meeting, but the idea that I was going to go get high was already there. And it was just a matter of time. And I left out a search for serenity on Thanksgiving night and went and got high. I went and picked one up in Pigtown and on the way home. And I ended up using for two to three days. You know, and I had a bank account because I had some clean time. And I used everything I had and went back to the house. And all I kept thinking was, actually, I used and I went back and I ended up in this lonely place along a river. And I used the last one, and all I kept hearing was this voice talking to me, and I thought I was hallucinating because I had used so much, and I probably was, but what I heard was this voice talking to me, and he said, Mike, and what I need to tell you is, like, when I worked the steps the first time for real, like, when I got to the third step, I turned my will and my life over to care of God, and he never forgot that. Like, I'm the one that ran away. And so I heard this voice, and I kept thinking, man, there's somebody walking down the road. And I was like, man, I don't know. I was like, ready to roll. And all I kept hearing was, are you done? Are you ready to start doing it my way and stop doing it your way? And I knew who that was. That was God. He was saying, I'm here. When are you coming back? And I guess because I had a head full of NA, I've been around a long time, like I knew. I went back to our apartment that we had moved into and shared, and I went back there. I got on my knees, and I told God, I said, I don't care what you do, take everything I got. Take it all. I just want to stay clean. I don't care if you take the truck. I don't care if you get rid of the relationship. Oh, I was surrendered. And of course, it didn't happen immediately because I had been shaking, and my mom, who's always been my number one enabler, had Tylenol 3 pills to give me to help me calm down. And so I used those for a few days, and my wife, we weren't married yet because we were trying to get married. So this was on December 8th of 2003 is when she looked at me and said, how many pills you got? I said, I got like one pill or something like that. And we said, let's flush it and go get a white key tag. Because she couldn't use the Tylenol. She's allergic to it. So so we did. We went and got a one-day key tag together. And we've been clean ever since. And so fast forward. So that was December 8th. And on December 21st, we got married in our living room by our pastor friend. And my sponsor at the time was there. And her sponsor at the time was there. So they were like our witnesses. So it was like a real spiritual thing. I was still messed up. Like, my sponsor was Mark D up to that point. And he told me, he said, you're going to use. You're going to get high. This is not the way you're supposed to be acting. Because I moved this in together. And I did all these crazy things. And I laughed at him and told him he didn't know what he was talking about. but he did. And I used. And so I went back to him, and it was rough for him too, because he loved me. He saw a lot of himself in me, which I found out later. And so I ended up having to get another. I went through another sponsor, and then I got another sponsor. And my sponsor, I asked, was this guy, this black guy, Calvin, that I was always going to his house for these meetings, and he had something that was just like me, is that he wanted people to love him so bad And I was the same way. And it didn't matter the color of our skin. And he said, Mike. And he always said, I'm happy, happy. That's how he always started all his meetings. I'm happy, happy, happy. And he said, Mike, he said, I want you to look at this book, Codependent No More. And there's not any literature. But I went and looked at it, and man, it opened my eyes to the relationships I was in, especially with my mom, who was my... It was the worst codependent relationship, and it was all my life. And we didn't know how to talk to each other, and that's where we're screaming and yelling at each other. And so I didn't know how to stop that. So, but a part of it is I started faking it until I made it. And it really was like I had to practice some stuff until it became real. And, like, I would have to go and, like, because I worked for my parents at a landscape business, so I'd have to go leave our place and go back to the house and see my mom almost every day, either in the morning or at night when I came back. And she didn't know how to relate to me unless it was screaming, yelling, throwing guilt and shame on me for the things that I did. Because by then I had two kids, and, like, they were living there at the house for a period. We were all living there at the house for a period of time before I ended up moving in with Carla. And it was just rough. But you know what I did was, is like, I just ignored it. And I would hold my tongue, and I would just deal with it. And I stopped responding, because my response was always, F you, Mom, or getting off some big yelling, screaming, arguing match about it over junk. And slowly, when I stopped participating in that, she stopped doing it as much. And it wasn't long after that she ended up getting dementia and all kinds of other stuff, and my mom, like, disappeared. So it was rough on my father, and then my mom passed several years later. But my father's still kicking, and he'll be 94 in March, and it's incredible. But so I went through that, and I went through my sponsor. We started doing step work, and I hated high school. So, like, I went to do step work. Like, I forced myself to write. Like, I hated writing. So that's part of faking it till you make it. Is I'm just gonna write whatever I can, and I still have trouble to this day doing step work, putting it on paper, because it takes time, and, like, my head is everywhere, especially now that we have phones and Facebook and all these things, like, can draw my attention everywhere. It's just how, like, I'm made. And so I have to turn all that off to do it, and it's pretty rough sometimes. But so, like, I just started going to meetings. And another thing too, like I said, I started doing the same thing. I went to 90 meetings in 90 days when I started again. And for the most part, I did. And when you get 90 meetings in 90 days, man, you end up going to get in the middle of this thing. It's something, the magic that happens, because you're in a meeting every night. You're starting to get recovery. You're starting to help people. And it just starts happening. Like, I'm watching it right now with a guy that I sponsor who's been struggling for years, and he's doing 90 and 90, and he's dead in the middle of it, and I can see it. And it gets me all excited. But, you know, so many times, like, I wanted to use through that time, and I didn't. Like, I was like, I'm not going to use no matter what. I would call my sponsor at the time, and I would call my wife, you know, and I would, like, I want to get high, because a lot of times I'd have a big bundle of cash in my pocket and be in the wrong place, and I would be like, and see the boys out on the corner and be like, it's real easy to pull right over and be accepted right back into that whole thing again and get that instant gratification. And a lot of times, like, I had to sit on my hands, like, driving down the road and things and doing things. And so, like, all that transferred. So, like, I started doing the step work. I ended up with another sponsor because Calvin ended up we went separate ways. He worked night shift, I worked day. He had some things going on with his life, and so it wasn't working. And then I stayed in the relationship too long. I ended up getting another sponsor, Jerry, and Jerry helped me get to step 12. And once I got to step 12, like, the spiritual awakening happened. Like, all of a sudden, man, the light bulbs went off, and I was just so grateful for Narcotics Anonymous. And like, I couldn't believe like I could get there. I was like, what am I doing here? Like, I must have done something. And really, a lot of times a faking it till you make it is just keep on going, no matter how much fear you got going on inside, is you just keep on going to do what you got to do. Especially with SEP work, especially with all of it, relationships. A big thing that I always fight still to this day is like, so I deal with a lot of customers. I own a landscape business that my parents had now. And whenever I go talk to new customers or even ones that I've had, like they all know, most of them that I have, I've had them since it was my father. So like they all know that I was an addict before and that I'm clean. And some of them have come and talked to me about their own kids and stuff, which is incredible. But a lot, my head still goes there and says, man, they don't like you. You're an addict. You got no business talking to them. They got $1 million like some of these mansions are like $3 or $4 million, and like they're just like regular people though. In the end, you know, and they talk to me with respect. And but every time I'm feared up. Like I pray in a truck outside if I'm meeting somebody new. Like I'm outside praying. Like God, please help me. Like my brain's going a million miles. And every time when I get up and face that fear of talking to them, it all goes away. It's all gone because it's all right here in my head. And, you know, so I learned that I just need to keep going and facing anything that gets brought in front of me. And really, God's going to keep bringing those things out for me to face. That's one thing that I've learned that I'm going through. And, you know, and it's helped me so many times to see me. You know, and to look at the, like, what am I afraid of? And it all goes back because I'm an addict, and a self-centered fear is still there. It can always come out in any situation. I've learned that over and over again. And so I have all these tools that Narcotics Anonymous gave me. You know, I have the meetings. You know, and I still go to the meeting. I still sit up front. I still talk. I still share. I still talk to people inside. I get there before the meeting. I stay after the meeting. I sponsor men, and like I'm not afraid to talk to them and ask them what the heck's going on with you. Where are you at with your step work? They'll tell you. Some are in this room. I'll tell you. Some of them get tired of me asking, and because I know that's the key, and because I don't know, it's nothing worse than being at a sponsee's funeral doing a eulogy. One of them was last year. He died during this convention on Friday night, and I had to go, and they asked me to speak there, and you know, and it was rough because another guy that had got, he couldn't stay clean for so long. He'd been in and out of program since the 80s, and he finally got a little clean time, but he would always stop step four, couldn't do it. Refused to pick it up. I mean, he would pick it up and then he put it down and never finished it. And then he ended up picking up, you know, for real. And, you know, and then it killed him. And it sucked because I loved that guy, Mike Evans. He was, we shared some stuff, you know. And he's not the only one. It's not the first time. So, like, those things keep me clean because I look back. Like, that's the experience that I got in my head that says, you need to stop doing whatever you're doing and take a look because you're going to end up there. And how many people are you going to hurt just like you got hurt from my sponsor, you know? And now, so my sponsor, Jerry, he had 21 years clean and picked up. And, I knew that day, like, I had to have another sponsor before the day was over because I'm, like, all in on recovery, and, like, I was just, like, I need to have another. Like, I called his sponsor. He didn't answer the phone. But I had a relationship with my original sponsor, Mark D., still. And I called him up, and I said, will you sponsor me, temporary sponsor me? And he said, yeah, because we go to the men's retreat that we've been doing. And we've been doing a men's retreat every year since 97 I've been there. I haven't missed a one, even through the relapse and all that. And actually, I started helping him run. So He said, sure, we'll do a temporary thing. You find somebody. But, it, you know, his wife, Cindy, was like, yeah, this is a God thing. This is where you belong. And really, it's true, because when I got back with him, like, everything fell into place. We went over, you know, it's funny, we went over step three. And again, all these years later, and I'm not, like, it's 24 years later, something like that, since I did it with him the first time. And man, it was great. And you know, and like, I still do, like, I still go to me, like, I, like, everybody sees me, like, I'm on Facebook or whatever, and I take a lot of pictures with people in recovery and all, like, I'm not afraid to do it. Like, I'll get in there and do it. Like, I always think about, my fear is like, people are always giving me a hard time and say, like, man, why are you doing all that, right? But I'm telling you, man, like, when COVID happened, I had all these pictures. I had all these videos from the convention. It was awesome to look back and say, man, like, because you knew, who was it, the end of the world? I don't know, but all I know is I had all these great memories, and I still do. I still do that. And it's hard because, like, I still face the fear. Like, I don't care at that point, you know, because it's about me and my recovery now. And other part that came in, and I wanted to think about this, is, like, Narcotics Anonymous. I was in a history meeting earlier, and they were talking about they faked it until they made it here in the Baltimore area. Like, they didn't have everything together, but they did what they had to do to get things started, to get the literature going, to have meetings. I mean, they only had like one meeting a day, you know, and before that they only had a few. And it's like, those people, some of them were here in this room earlier, and like, they kept coming and doing what they had to do, and they had to travel up and down the East Coast back then to participate in all these area services or regional services and things like that. And today we got lucky that we had so many meetings in Baltimore area. Like, you got choices to go to meetings, you know, today on each day. Even when I first started coming around, there wasn't choices every day. There was like one meeting a lot of times, and that's how you got to know everybody. So, like, that was a fake it till you make it, facing fear. And so that was the other thing, is just, I faced it until I made it, and I'm still here, and I'm still making it, as far as I'm concerned. I ain't going no freaking where, because Narcotics Anonymous saved my life and gave me one. Thanks for letting me share.
And now I would like to introduce our second speaker, Christina. Can you come on up?
Woo-hoo! I'm an addict, Christina. So I've been in my head today because I've been to a few meetings. We're at a convention, right? We go to meetings, and the meetings have topics, right? And I'm watching people walk up to the podium, and one of them's got like this binder for his preparation, and he's opening it up, and he's got references, and, you know, and then my daughter spoke after him, and she's got all these notes in her phone on what she's speaking on, and I'm thinking, fuck, I don't have anything to, like, I don't have any props, I got, you know, and then you come up, and you got these fucking tea tags, and I'm like, I look like shit, right? But, look, when Cassie called and asked me to do this meeting, she asked me if I would be willing to do, you know, speak at a meeting here, and I said yes before she told me the topic. And then when she told me the topic, this was my first thought. If I tell people about how I fake it until I make it, are they gonna then think I'm not honest, I'm not genuine, I'm faking shit, so how are you going to know what's real and what isn't real? And am I telling you the truth, or am I just telling you what you want to hear so that you won't ask me anything? That's what immediately came to my mind. So how do you prepare to say that shit and get honest and say, I'm going to tell you guys the truth, because I've faked a lot of shit in my life. And I've been, look, I started faking it till I made it way before I got here. You know, if you know me, the only thing I ever wanted to do in my life was become a mother. Like, I didn't have dreams of, you know, being rich or having a mansion or, you know, any of that. That was not my dream. My dream was to be a mom, right? And so I didn't have a set thought in my head of, well, a partner in life. Like, I never thought I'd, like, find my knight in shining armor. I never thought I'd find a man that would fulfill me. All I needed him for was, you know, so that I could have a baby, right? I'm remembering that this is being taped and my kids may listen to this. So I'm trying to stay out of my head but be respectful. So I found this guy. Well, he found me. And I was 20 and he was 30. Wait a minute. I don't know. Somewhere around there. He was older. And he fell in love with me, and I married him, right? I thought he would be a good dad. I never thought what it would take to keep a marriage together, to have a mother and father for my child to be a good, happy home. I only thought of myself, and I want this kid, right? So I faked 29 years with this man. I never fell in love with him. I didn't like him. I treated him with respect. I honored him. I didn't disrespect him. But I never grew in a relationship with him. And he just thought that kids, since she was a girl, it took me 9 years to get pregnant. Like, God really worked on me with that one. There was no enjoyment in the making of my daughter. The enjoyment came when she was born. But I believe that it was a process for me to find gratitude, to be honest. You can't keep something together and continue trying to have a baby and not be able to fake something to keep going, you know, to keep doing that. And then after I had her, I was thinking, I don't want to get out of this because I want her to have every advantage in life, and that means a two-parent household, right? I feel like I sacrificed myself all my life. I'm no martyr. I'm not perfect. Trust me. But I feel like I faked that and I got really good at it. I was smoking crack for a couple years in our home and he had no clue. I was still cooking dinner. I was still going to work every day. I was still doing what I was supposed to do. But he was so far removed from my feelings, myself as a person, what my needs and wants were, that he didn't even know I've been smoking crack for years, right? It's not his fault. I was really good at faking it. He thought he had a happy home. The house was clean. Dinner was made. I was making plenty of money. The baby was good. She was, you know, all this. So I had everything set for him to just believe that we were happy. Long story short, I don't want to spend all this time on this shit, but I eventually get out of the marriage, right? I left when I was so caught up in the grips that I couldn't care for my child anymore. And I had to fucking admit that he could. And I had to abandon her with him because at that time, the crip had such a hold on me that I couldn't even consider what she needed in her life. That's what this disease does, right? It robs you of your miracles. So I go and get help. I surrender. I go into a treatment center and I'm getting ready to get out of this treatment center, and I'm in such denial, I'm thinking, oh, I'll just go back to my house right now. I hadn't been there in 2 years, but I owned it, right? I owned it, and, you know, so, I mean, those 2 years I wasn't making any payments because I was, you know, but my head was, I can go back home, right? I got a nice house. That was not an option, obviously, but I had to figure out something to do, and I had burnt every bridge, every friendship that I had used to its fullest extent until they didn't want to be friends anymore. And so when I got out of treatment, I had to go to a recovery house in a place that I had never been to before. It's called Dundalk, Maryland. So I'm scared to death. I don't know a single soul when I get out of this treatment center and I go to this recovery house and I go to this first. I didn't go to Dundalk first. First, I went to Gulf Street. I don't know if anybody knows where that is, but okay. So I went there first, and it was a week. It was a Friday night. It was a weekend of a convention, and the whole house was empty. They were all at a convention, and the owner allowed me to come in there by myself. Okay. I'm a county girl, so I had never seen a rat before. I was scared to death. I saw my first rats. I saw things on the corner, like out the window, and I was like, where the fuck am I? Like, how did I end up here, right? Like, I'm in denial of all the shit that I did to cut off all the good things in my life that put me where I'm at. And I'm just like, how did this happen to me? I stayed there for, I don't know, it was like 2 weeks of hell. And let me tell you, I was so scared, but I acted so tough. I hardened myself. I hardened my heart. I hardened my spirit. I hardened who I was because I couldn't let you know that I wasn't okay. And I had to fake that shit every day. And all I wanted to do was cry out and say, help me. Please help me. But I couldn't do it. I finally got out of that place and I ended up at this recovery house in Dundalk on the water. It was gorgeous. There was only 3 girls in it. We had a pier and a like paddle boat, and I was like, I'm in heaven, right? And I did all the things we were supposed to do. I did the 90 and 90. I think if I count correctly, I did like 412 meetings in my first year. So I did the 90 and 90. I got the sponsor. I got a home group. I got a service position. I did all the things that we were supposed to do. But I couldn't find my connection with God. And like, I've grown up in faith all my life. I've had faith all my life that, like, God was there, even in my active addiction. I knew God was there. I was ashamed of myself and my actions and my behaviors that I didn't want to recognize that he could see what I was doing. Like, that's where my denial was. If I don't recognize that he sees what I'm doing, I'm going to keep acting out. I'm going to keep living this way until it fucking kills me. So this one day... I'm sitting on the end of that pier at that recovery house, and I'm just dangling my feet. And I had a spiritual awakening. And this feeling came over me that said, what are you doing? How much more time are you going to waste? What if today's your last day? What if today's your last day and you've been holding yourself back and you've been lying to people and faking this life that you're all good, and tomorrow's, you're not going to be here anymore. how, and in my head I thought, I gotta start living. Like, I don't want to exist in here. I existed out there. I gotta start living. And the only way to live is to be free. And the only way to be free was to turn my life over to God. To turn my life over and believe in God and myself. I didn't believe in myself for years. So like that child that I talk about was my miracle, right? Like she starts using. She grew up coming to these meetings and she starts using, and I can't see it. Everybody around me is in recovery. Everybody's telling me your daughter's using, and I'm like, no, she's not. No way. She solves. I mean, my husband was such a maniac, and he did not want me to leave. He would do anything for me not to leave. That he would put her in the vehicle at night. Hey, I don't know if he had a tracker on me or what. He would pull up to a motel, get my daughter. It'd be 2 a.m. Pull her, 5, 6 years old, out of the car, knock on the hotel room door that I was in, and say, your mother's in there. And I would open up the door because he said, I called 911, and if you don't come out of there, they're going to come get your daughter. And like he did things like that, right? Because he just wanted me home. He didn't care what I was out there doing. Just come home and be with me. You could have used that codependency book you were talking about. But I want to tell you that, like, it was 2 years of hell for me trying to save my daughter. All those things that I did to get all that clean time, like, you know, all the service work, I sponsored women, I went through the steps, I did a lot of work on myself, right? But when something like that hits you in your core and you stop doing all the things that got you to where you are, like you stop doing that stuff and you regress, right? Well, I didn't regress because I wasn't telling people how I was feeling. And every week, like I was chasing her at all the places, the alleys, the strip clubs, and I was chasing her every day because I had to save her. I'm her mother, right? I have to save her. Nobody else can save her. It's my job. I'm her mother, right? So I think it was like 19 overdoses and 12 suicide attempts, or the numbers are reversed. It's not clear. It's 19 and 12. I don't know whether they're overdoses or suicide attempts, but it's one or the other. Like, this is an honest program, Graham. I can't remember which one is which. Because it's horrible to have to know that. Like, I don't want to remember that. But if I don't remember that, and I don't remember that I spent my time chasing her, and I stopped going to meetings, and I stopped being of service, and I stopped sponsoring women responsibly, and I stopped doing all the things that got me there, and finally, she got it, right? She got clean. She got in this program. She's doing fine. And every week, my sponsor would tell me, you're going to use. And this went on for 2 years. And I said, I can't use. I got too much to do. I gotta save my daughter. So when she did get clean, I was so far removed from this program that I was trying to save her and bring her into that I had kind of pulled away from in order to save her. It was like the sixth cycle, right? So I go out on a date because she's safe now. And the guy says, what do you want to drink? And I said, an Orange Crush. And that quick, I had 9 years, 11 months, and a week clean. I was 3 weeks from double digits. And that easy, I had an Orange Crush. And then when I had the Orange Crush, I was, at the time, I was still sponsoring 5 women. And the next morning I woke up and I was like, I gotta call my sponsor. I gotta call these women. And I did. And then I thought, I'm not going to pick up a white key tag. Fuck that. And so I came to an acceptance that I was never coming back here. I'm going to be okay because I've lived 10 years clean, right? Almost. 9 years, 11 months, whatever. And I thought I would be okay, right? Because that's the disease. That's the lie, right?
Yeah.
So I start making friends. I'm like going to bars and meet some friends with yachts and some, you know, and I'm having this good old time. And one of my friends, Crystal, that was a friend of mine, she wasn't my sponsor my first 10 years. She was my friend. She was the only person in this program that reached out to me during my relapse of 3 years. And every probably 2 or 3 months, she would reach out to me and say, "Dude, you are the only person I have ever known that makes me want to come with you on your fucking extravaganza trips. Like, you really make using look attractive to me. And that's scary." And I said, "It's all a mirage. I hate myself. I hate myself. But I can't stop now because it's been too long. And I'm caught up." And she said, "I love you, and I'm here for you, and I will always keep my door open for you." So, after about 3 years, my daughter shows up at my house with a UA cup in hand because she was just, you know, had, actually both of them showed up, Shelby and Fawn, and they showed up with a UA and said, "If you don't take this, you'll never see me again." And I said, "I don't have to take the test." And they looked at me and said, "I know, Mom, there's white shit all over your face." And I felt like this. And I could see the pain in their eyes and the humiliation that they felt. And all I wanted was to not see that. And so I went to rehab. That was December 29th of 2020. I had a hard time getting in the car to go there. Like, they sent a car to pick me up. I had my own car, and I wanted to drive my car. And they said, "No, we'll pick you up, right?" And, I surrendered, fully. My clean date is December 30th because I got to tell you, they waited in the driveway for a minute while I was down there doing everything I could to shove everything in me that I could before I got in that car because I knew the pain that I was going to have to feel without the drug to cover the pain. So I get in rehab, right? And the intake person says, "Hey, I'm going to put you in a trauma class." And I was like, "I don't have any trauma. Why do you want to put me in a trauma class?" And she said, "I just have a feeling." And I said, this is a swanky rehab. You know, maybe it's not like the one that I went to the first time to get clean. Like, maybe you just, you know, swanky, whatever. So we get in this, it's like day 2 or 3, and they put me in this trauma class. And I'm sitting in there, it's two other women and this like counselor lady, and it's like mood lighting and the music starts, and I'm like, yeah, I feel pretty good, right? And I don't know how many minutes it was, and I, like, this is a God moment for me, okay? This music started, and all of a sudden, it was like I was watching a movie. And the memories of my stepfather having sex with me from the age of 8 to 13 came to my mind, and I had never known it all my life. Like, it had been locked away in this place in my brain. And look, my first 10 years clean, I went through the 12 steps, like, and I trusted my sponsor, and I poured everything into that. There was nothing in here that told me I had been fucked by my stepfather, right? But this time, I'm in rehab for a few days, and here it comes. And I am floored. I'm like, what is happening? Like, is this real? Like, did you guys slip something in my drink? Because I like this music. I like the, like, what is this? And wow. So I can't tell my family. Like, my stepfather's dead, right? He was dead before, you know, 4 years ago when I went to rehab. I couldn't tell my family because I didn't. Look, I have different brothers and sisters from different parents and marriages and all that shit. And I was like, I do not want to fuck up the dynamic of my family. This is my cross to bear. This, somehow I made this happen, right? So I had to fake that I was okay. I got 5 minutes to get to the end of this. I had to fake that I was okay to everybody in my family because I didn't want them to know what had really happened for all that time, because I thought in my head, they're going to think that they're responsible for it and that they could have stopped it, right? I love my dad. Like, my parents divorced. I went to my dad's house every other weekend, and like, I had a year clean. I'm into a year clean, and I'm sitting at my dad's house because he's like my hero. Not my stepfather. This is my father we're talking about. And we're watching the game, and he said, Chris, why are you going to so many different therapists and psychologists this time? Meaning, not my first 10 years, but I'm always like in psychologists and therapist meetings. And I looked at him and I couldn't lie. I couldn't fake it anymore. And I told him what happened, and he said, I kept wondering why you kept running away and calling me to come pick you up. I would do it every few weeks, right? I would just call my dad, please come get me. And I would run away from my mom's house where my stepfather was, because that's where the abuse was happening. And my dad sat there. And he said, I'm sorry I didn't save you. I'm sorry I didn't see it. It was a lot to work through. It was a lot to work through these past 4 years, you know. But the last thing that I want to talk about before I shut this down is, like, that person that kept calling me while I was in relapse mode became my sponsor the last 4 years, right? And her name's Crystal. And she died unexpectedly. And I have never had a family member. I have my parents. I have my brothers and sisters. I have my kids. I have my friends. I have my sponsees. No one that I love has ever died. Maybe when I was a little kid, my grandparents. And it rocked me. It rocked me to my core. And I didn't want to be anywhere anymore. I didn't want to be here. I didn't want to talk to anybody. But see, I had to keep faking that I was okay because I couldn't have my children get nervous that it's going to take me back out, because I've got 4 years clean now. I don't have 17. I got four. I couldn't let my friends know that I wasn't okay because they kept saying, how are you doing? You know, have you found a new sponsor? And I'm like, I'm not done grieving. I'm still grieving. I can't, I'm not ready. I'm not ready. But then, you know, people kept saying, you have to get a sponsor. So, the only person that made sense for me to sponsor me was the person who was my sponsee sister, who my sponsor had taken through the first 12 steps, right? And thank God. And I called her this week because I thought I was supposed to prepare for this. I know I got to shut it down. And I said, am I supposed to, is there some work that I'm supposed to do before I do this meeting? I've never spoken at a local convention. I've done Philly and Jersey and New York, the Bronx. But I've never done one in this area. Like, nobody there knew me, and I could just share freely. I didn't have to worry about affecting my children or this or that. Like, I just spoke. And I said, I'm afraid to tell people that I fake it until I make it in situations, because then I'm going to feel as though no one's going to believe me anymore. And that is the most important thing to me, is that I am honest, that I have integrity, and that what I tell you is the truth. So if I stand up here and tell you I had to fake it until I make it, are you still going to feel that way about me? But here's the thing, it's not about how you feel about me anymore. It's about how I feel about myself. And it's about loving myself and not worrying about whether you love me or not. So, I love you too. I just want to say that I love this program. I love this fellowship. I hear so many people say, you know, I love this program, but the fellowship sucks. Well, I wouldn't be here without this fellowship. Like, whose experience am I supposed to get if I don't have ties in this fellowship? So, I don't know. I just want to thank the ladies that showed up for me. The people that are here are supposed to be here, and the message that came out is what came out. So thanks for letting me share.
I want to thank Christina and Mark for sharing on this.
Mike.
Mike, not Mark. I'm tired. I'm so sorry. A reminder, entertainment for tonight. Karaoke is in the Owens room, and Karma, the ultimate rock band, which started, I think, about a half hour ago, is in the Warfield ballroom. Yeah, both start at 10. See, I need to go to bed. Can we close this meeting with a moment of silence followed by the serenity prayer? God, grant me the